Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, New York just greenlit construction on the controversial NESE fracked gas pipeline. Environmental advocates are gearing up to fight it again and its companion, the Constitution Pipeline. Genevieve Hartnett speaks with the NRDC on what's driving these projects and how statewide opposition could stop them. Parents in Sullivan County are being forced to make a choice: work or pay for childcare. The state's child care assistance program, meant to help families cover daycare costs, is on pause. We'll learn why. Seniors, beware. Medicare scammers are on the move this open enrollment season. We'll tell you how to protect yourself. Plus, Brooklyn artist Flaco Jimenez and a work that inspired his latest stage work, caring for his grandmother. That's coming up after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Democrats on the House Oversight Committee have released several emails from the estate of convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. These refer to President Trump. NPR Stephen Fowler reports the emails raise new questions about the extent of the relationship between Trump and Epstein.
The three emails appear to show more of a connection between Trump and the disgraced financier than previously reported. One thread called Trump, quote, that dog that hasn't barked. Another said Trump, quote, of course, knew about the girls, without elaborating further. NPR has not independently confirmed the veracity of the correspondence. The revelation comes as the House returns to action today for government funding bills and will have enough members to vote on a bipartisan measure to release more Epstein files. Epstein died by suicide in 2019 while awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges. Stephen Fowler, NPR News.
The decisive vote in the House to release more Epstein files is expected to come from Arizona Congresswoman-elect Adelita Grijalva. It's been 50 days since the Democrat won a special election. She's expected to be sworn into office this afternoon. Grijalva believes the delay in administering her oath of office is linked to her support for the release of the Epstein material.
I do believe that there is absolutely a connection with me pledging to be the 218th signature on the discharge petition to release the Epstein files, and that has resulted in denying representation to more than 800,000 Arizonans for the last 7 weeks.
She spoke to NPR's All Things Considered. Grijalva will also be seated in time to vote with the House on the spending measure intended to bring an end to the government shutdown. Today is day 43. The vote is expected to be close, as House Democratic leaders say they will not support it. The measure does not cover a key Democratic demand, restoring cuts to subsidies for ACA health care insurance premiums. Stocks open mixed ahead of a House vote to end the shutdown. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 450 points in early trading.
The six-week shutdown has been a drag on the U.S. economy. Congressional forecasters estimate it will shave about 1.5 percentage points off the annual growth rate in fourth quarter GDP. The government economists who tally GDP growth are among those furloughed by the shutdown. We are still waiting for a readout on third quarter economic growth that was supposed to come out 2 weeks ago. One of the first economic reports we are likely to see once the shutdown ends is the September jobs report. That was nearly finished when government number crunchers were told to stop working. Stock and computer chip maker AMD opened higher after the company offered a rosy sales forecast driven by the growth of AI data centers. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, stocks remain mixed. The Dow Jones Industrials are now up 440 points. The Nasdaq is down 30. This is NPR. Japan and China are continuing their verbal sparring. It's over remarks made by Japan's prime minister concerning Taiwan. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports that both countries have lodged diplomatic protests against each other.
Two foreign affairs divisions of Japan's ruling Liberal Democratic Party adopted a resolution calling on the government to take firm measures, including possibly expelling China's consul general in the city of Osaka. The consul posted on social media what was widely interpreted as a threat to decapitate Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi. Takaichi suggested last week that a Chinese attack on Taiwan could constitute a threat to Japan's survival that could justify a military response. A social media account associated with China's state broadcaster, meanwhile, said in a post that if Takaichi continues to spout nonsense, she might have to pay the price. Spout nonsense is a sanitized translation for words that we can't use on air. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
The National Weather Service says a looming storm in the Pacific Ocean will deliver what's known as an atmospheric river to California this week. Forecasters say strong winds and heavy rain will pelt the state. There are winter storm warnings posted already for California's eastern mountains. Heavy snow is forecast. The funeral for renowned primatologist Jane Goodall will be held today in Washington National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. Goodall died last month at the age of 91. The services will be live streamed starting at 11 a.m. Eastern Time in about an hour. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Total Wine & More, offering a variety of beverages for gatherings and crisp fall nights. More at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. The once-dead Northeast Supply Enhancement Fracked Gas Pipeline Project, or NESE, or NESE, is now one more step toward being revived. Last Friday, New York's Department of Environmental Conservation issued a water quality certification permit for the construction of the project, effectively reversing its legal position under the Federal Clean Water Act in 2019 and 2020. While environmental advocates and legal experts are preparing to stop NESE again, which could run from central PA through New Jersey and into New York City, they're also looking ahead to the inevitable revival of its companion project, the Constitution Pipeline, that would run through upstate New York. Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett spoke with Mark Eisman, Senior Attorney for Environmental Health at National Resources Defense Council and Board Chair of Catskill Mountain Keeper, about the increased federal pressure pushing these pipeline projects forward and how statewide opposition can stop them.
We're here to talk about this pipeline being approved by New York's Department of Environmental Conservation. DEC has just recently given a water quality certification to the Northeast Supply Enhancement Pipeline, which they had rejected in the past. Can you first explain New York's water quality certification and how some projects get it and how others don't?
We're talking about a pipeline that would go through a little bit of Pennsylvania, then all the way across New Jersey, and then rip up 23 miles of the seafloor in the New York, New Jersey harbor. It's called the NESE pipeline. Under federal law, most state laws are preempted, meaning when the federal government, through the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, approves a pipeline, there are only a few obstacles that's to prevent it from being built if a state doesn't want the pipeline. One of those is what they call water quality certification under the Federal Clean Water Act, meaning in simple terms, the states have to determine that this proposed pipeline will be consistent with its state water quality standards. And in 2019 and in 2020, New York State environmental officials said this pipeline would not comply with water quality standards. They couldn't make that determination and rejected the pipeline. This is the exact same pipeline. And so state environmental regulators here have taken a 180-degree turn without any rational explanation.
I actually spoke to Chris Casey a little under a month ago in regards to it getting approved by the Public Service Commission, and a lot of their decision was based on National Grid's reports for energy estimates, which Chris Casey alleged were very out of date with what the needs actually are. How much were those measurements considered in this decision?
Well, there are different components of approval of a pipeline like this. What happened on Friday was that the state made a determination inconsistent with its two previous determinations that it would satisfy state water quality standards. Under the Clean Water Act, which is a federal law, they can only look at water issues. So whether the pipeline is needed or not, whether it has greenhouse gases emissions or not, whether it'll raise costs or not, all of which are issues that we've discussed in other forums. But with respect to this issue, The only issue legally that the state could look at is whether it would be would comply with state water quality standards. And again, the state has taken a complete reversal from where it was in 2019, 2020.
So if I'm getting what you're saying, it's being basically fought through multiple legal avenues, both the need for it, but also reversing this water quality decision.
DEC was supposed to only look at water quality issues for this particular determination. Separately, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission down in Washington can look at other issues, which we allege they haven't in a proper way. And then the state's Public Service Commission has a different set of issues that it looks at, primarily need and whether a pipeline like this should be built based on capacity.
Great deal. This pipeline will go through New York City, will go through Raritan Bay, New York Bay, right by the city. We obviously just had a very big election here. How do you anticipate the incoming administration of Mayor-elect Mamdani will work with this pipeline or reject it? And do you think that there is that's potentially why it's being pushed through so fast, you know, before he's sworn in?
Yeah. Well, one thing to keep in mind is that the city of New York, as an official governmental body, submitted comments to the state's Public Service Commission, which not a lot of people hear about. And what the city said is this pipeline was unnecessary. So one of the main jurisdictions that would receive the gas if it was built says the pipeline is not necessary. The incoming mayor, Mamdani, has also indicated that he doesn't support this pipeline. With the approval from New York State on the water quality certification and with the approval down in Washington by FERC, it's unclear what the next steps are. I think that everyone is looking at all possibilities, including legal action.
Would it be a referendum put out to people, or would it just be a legal fight in the city next?
I don't think there'd be a referendum. There's only a few ways in which a state could reject a pipeline, and one of them is under this water quality certification. NRDC lawyers working with lawyers from Earth Justice and representing clients has already filed a lawsuit in federal appeals court in Washington over the FERC ruling. And we're exploring all the options with respect to New York State's approval, as well as New Jersey's water quality certification, which happened on the same day.
What is happening right now with Constitution? I know that got the approval from FERC, but what is happening with that DEC water certification? Mm-hmm.
Right. Both the NESE pipeline, which would cut across the harbor into New York City, and the Constitution pipeline, which would cut across large swath of New York State and then bring gas to New England. Both of those pipelines were rejected on water quality grounds last time. Mm-hmm. And then with respect to the Constitution pipeline, the company had initially asked New York for water quality certification, but it withdrew its application. So New York State didn't have to take any action with respect to Constitution. Will that pipeline come back? I think there's a strong likelihood that the Williams Company, which is one of the largest oil and gas companies in the country, they would conceivably file a new application down in Washington before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and then ask New York State again for water quality certification. At this point in time, there is no pending application.
So they're trying to move NESE through before they really take a lot of the steps with Constitution. Is that what you're saying?
It appears that way. Mm-hmm. They've moved on NESE. Unclear what will happen on Constitution, but I think that everyone should be prepared for that pipeline to also come back as well.
Obviously, this is being fought at the legal level. It's not even really in political bodies yet, although there is political influence in it. If listeners are interested, what can they do to remark their opposition to this if they have it?
Well, I would just say that the voice from the Catskills, including through Catskill Mountain Keeper, but many of the citizens here, their opposition last time to the Constitution in particular really made a difference. And that's why it was rejected. And so I would just say that it's a good time to let your opinion be known to the governor, to state environmental officials, to the Public Service Commission, to your elected officials. Most elected officials that have spoken out have been against the pipeline in New York. And so I would just continue to keep this as a top issue, because building this pipeline will not only jeopardize New York's, or both pipelines, jeopardize water quality, but it's also not necessary. It'll increase utility rates by ratepayers, and it will contribute more to global warming, as the company itself admits.
Well, thank you very much, Mark, for speaking with us today, and we really appreciate your time.
Great. Thanks so much.
In Liberty, I'm Genevieve Hartnett for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, childcare costs are rising and a state program meant to help is on pause. Stay tuned to hear how it's impacting local families and providers. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on This American Life, there's a spot in Mackenzie and Isabella's house that's perfect for eavesdropping on their parents. It's a small sitting nook on the second floor, right at the top of the stairs.
So you can hear everything that's going on. They'll have the door closed and you can hear murmurs. We're kind of in the shadow, like, I know what's going on, but I don't know exact things.
What they've been overhearing for the last year, and what they think of it this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
On the next Radio Lab.
I'm like, what's going on?
Is that our house?
A fire.
I don't think this could have been an accidental fire.
Once they tell me it's a crime, I'm moving.
A murder trial.
Three firefighters died.
I was just totally devastated.
And a bizarre,
outrageous, absurd
plea deal.
Pleading guilty while maintaining your innocence.
How is this allowed? Like, what? Is this a thing?
The Alford plea. That's on the next Radio Lab. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Families in Sullivan County are facing a tough choice. Go to work or pay for childcare. New York's Child Care Assistance Program, or CCAP, which helps cover daycare costs for eligible families, has been paused in Sullivan and more than 30 other counties throughout New York. Isabel Braverman is the editor of the Sullivan County Democrat. She's been covering the story and joins us now to explain what's happening, who it's affecting, and when families can expect relief. Isabel, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you give listeners a quick overview of what CCAP is, who it's meant to help, and why it's been paused in Sullivan and 30 other counties throughout New York?
Sure. So CCAP is a state program that is administered through the counties, specifically the county's, you know, Health and Human Services departments. And it's meant to help families and parents pay for daycare. So there are eligibility requirements, you know, such as your income levels. And based on that, you can receive a certain amount to help pay for the cost of daycare, sometimes having it even be fully covered. The issue right now is that the state expanded the program, you know, which sounds like a good thing. It allows more families to enroll and receive the funding, but it can't keep up with the growing demands, and so counties are running out of money to be able to administer.
And so what happened in Sullivan County with the increased demand? They put that program on pause. When did they do that, and when will it likely resume?
So the pause began in July. Starting on July 1st, the county cannot accept any new or renewals of the program. However, if you were currently enrolled, you will still receive the funding for the remainder of your 12-month period of the assistance. Now, you know, the answers, we don't have exact answers of when this program will be available again, but it may not be until January of next year.
Because of budget considerations, and the new proposed budget is out there for the county, right? What is it doing for families? And then also not just families, it's affecting daycare providers who are you know, seeing some kids leave or maybe reduce their hours as well.
Right. Yeah, I've spoken to a couple daycare providers. They've already seen some kids drop out because their parents are choosing to stay home rather than go to work and not be able to afford the cost for daycare. And they're also seeing a few kids, drop down from full-time to part-time. So it's putting a strain not only on the families, but on the daycare providers as well.
You spoke to the director of Twin Bridge Play School here in Liberty near us. What did she have to say about this and how it's impacting their specific school?
Yeah, she is really quite concerned about this. She said they've already had four kids leave due to not having this assistance, and a few others dropped to part-time. She said it's really not sustainable for them as a daycare. And to give a picture of how many kids there receive CCAP, they can have 32 children signed up in their daycare. Out of those 32, all but three receive the CCAP assistance. So only three families pay, the full out-of-pocket cost for it.
And I refer to it as a school. It's a play school. It's a daycare center, Twin Bridge. You also spoke to Jessica's daycare in Monticello, Jessica Dean, the owner there. What did she have to say about the situation?
Yeah, so she is really has become an advocate in the face of this going on. She is reaching out to county leaders, state leaders, the state, family services department. And so not only is she facing this as an owner of a daycare, but she's really advocating for CCAP to come back and to make funds available.
And let's talk about the advocacy work, because there are some possible solutions. What are some of those solutions that are out there?
Yeah, so some of the things that the providers have talked about, and as well as John Little, the director of Health and Human Services, have talked about is going back to the former eligibility process to get CCAP. And so that means, Tricia from the Liberty daycare said that formerly parents who were receiving assistance would only pay about $50 a week, and now they pay $5 a week with the expanded program. So she's recommending, going back to that previous payment structure just in the interim to have more funds free up so they can start these delayed applications.
And so that would allow for more people to still be enrolled, with more people paying a little bit more. Okay.
Yes, exactly. And
is there any sort of legislation at the state level or any action that's being considered right now? Where do things sort of stand?
Right now at the state level, there isn't really anything specific that they're looking at. Basically, their response is that, it's been the governor's priority to expand childcare to everyone in New York State, and that this program is doing that. And they have released some additional funds to counties. They said Sullivan County got an additional $225,000. However, John Little, the director of Health and Human Services, said that only took them so far. It didn't, it wasn't enough to keep up with the demands that they're still seeing.
Yeah, it seems like it's a fairly large chunk of change, but it doesn't cover folks. And in fact, I guess in Sullivan, it only covered for 6 months of the year.
Right.
We still don't know where things stand or when things might resume. What did John Little tell you about, communication at the state level?
He said he's in touch with them a lot. Him and his team work with them to try to find solutions to this. And what they're hearing is that it may not start again until January, but even that is not a definite. So they're really not sure when it can, reopen.
And has there been a response from New York State or the Office of Child and Family Services? What are they saying about the situation?
Yeah, they're saying that, that it's sort of just in line with their goals of expanding access to child care, just as a general goal for the state, because this did allow more families to get funding, before it was paused. And that they will just continue to look at ways to, release more funding.
And we mentioned Jessica Dean. She's the owner of Jessica's Daycare in Monticello. She's become an advocate. She's also in the process of creating a nonprofit. Tell us about what that is, what it would do, and you know what she's thinking about that idea for a solution.
Yeah, so she wants to create a nonprofit that would give out scholarships to families to help them to pay for daycare or, you know, other kinds of childcare. She wants to gather donations that will fund this scholarship fund. And she's really just taking this upon herself to try to do something and start, you know, putting something into action while everyone waits for CCAP.
Yeah, and there's still, again, not much time left with this year. So I guess folks are kind of looking into 26 in terms of, you know, where things might resume.
Right.
That's Elizabeth. That's Isabel Braverman. She's the editor of the Sullivan County Democrat. Her story about the CCAP pause is at scdemocratonline.com. And while we have you, Isabel, any other stories in the current issue of the Democrat you want folks to be aware of when they go to the website to visit?
Yeah, we have, you know, we always cover the Sullivan County Legislature. So we have two stories out of that. County Legislature Chair Nadia Raj discussed the proposed county budget at a recent Town of Forestburg Town Board meeting. And Sullivan County residents have the chance to comment on the budget at two upcoming public hearings on December 2nd and December 4th before the legislature votes on that budget, which includes a 9.1% tax increase. And also out of the county legislature, they discussed some of the upcoming economic development projects that will likely be coming to the county next year.
All right. Sullivan County Democrat on newsstands or at scdemocratonline.com. Isabel Braverman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, it's open enrollment season for Medicare and also open season for scammers. We'll tell you how to protect yourself after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Catskills Property Care, offering full property care year-round for commercial and residential properties in Sullivan County, including snow plowing, landscaping, property checkups, and more. Information at catskillspropertycare.com. And from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. Calicoontheater.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
We believe nonpartisan, nonprofit news is essential to a healthy community. And as a Radio Catskill listener, we're guessing you feel the same way. We deliver fact-based journalism that holds the powerful accountable and keeps our community informed. Every story we produce is powered by listeners like you. And right now, through December 31st, your gift to Radio Catskill will be matched dollar for dollar, up to $1,000 by Newsmatch. Support local news and information. Give now at WJFFradio.org. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's open enrollment season for Medicare, and while many older adults are comparing plans and coverage, consumer advocates are warning that it's also open season for scammers. The New York Statewide Senior Action Council is sounding the alarm about Medicare enrollment fraud and their ongoing campaign to protect seniors from healthcare scams. Statewide's Executive Director Maria Alvarez says con artists are getting more sophisticated, pretending to be from Medicare, offering fake rewards, or pressuring seniors to hand over personal information. I spoke with Alvarez about how to spot the warning signs and where to turn for help.
As many people might know, right now, up until December 7th, we are in the Medicare annual enrollment period, which is when many people make their selections for what their health care is going to be for, you know, their coverage is going to be for next year. And I would say that even if you are comfortable with what your health care coverage is right now, that you could still have the opportunity to check to make sure that it's still the right coverage. You know, people's health situations might change, the plan might have changed, the coverage might have changed, there might be other options. And so this is the time when most people are able to assess that situation. Now, as with anything that happens, there's also some scams that people should be aware of in the middle of all this, because it is a very, you know, this time, these plans, there are so many options. It can get confusing. And so many times the unscrupulous people might want to take advantage of that and try to confuse people into giving up their Medicare number. So one of the things I would tell you is that sometimes people will call and claim to represent Medicare. So I want to tell everybody, and that's like a basic for anything, that Medicare, Social Security, or the IRS, they will never call a person at their home. They will never say, hi, I'm from Medicare, and I would like to, you know. And because they already, because that's their policy. And much less would they ever call and ask for a person's Medicare number, because they already have that information. There is no need for that. So that's the first thing I would tell people to be aware of. Anybody who calls and says that they're from Medicare, hang up the phone immediately, because it's not them. They will never call. So because these scammers may ask for personal information. So and many times they have the information, and what they're trying to do is to get the person to confirm that, because then they're sure that it's a that the information is accurate, and then they're able to start charging medications, procedures, durable medical equipment, or enrolling people into plans that without their consent or knowledge. So never give out your Medicare number, your Social Security number, your bank or credit card numbers into information to an unsolicited caller or visitor. That is something that we should always, though these are the basics, the 101 yeah. about, you know, protecting our Medicare and Social Security.
And as a basic, and we've talked about that as sort of a basic before, are there particular groups of seniors who are more vulnerable to these types of scams when folks are calling and claiming to be a Medicare representative?
Actually, no. They will, because many times people might think, oh, well, they had my number, or how did they know I'm on Medicare? They must have known who I was.
Or they must need to get in touch with me then, yeah.
Right. And these are just random calls that these scam artists are making. So if you hang up and you say, I don't have Medicare, then they'll hang up and they'll dial somebody else. So this is very, this is random. But also understand that they are looking for, they're trying to cobble together information that they may have on you, and then confirm it and elicit that information from you, so that then they can perpetrate their crimes.
So you mentioned that if you get that call, you should hang up, but should seniors do anything else, other steps they should take immediately if they suspect they're being targeted or enrolled without consent, for example?
Absolutely. Number one is they could always call the New York State Senior Medicare Patrol, which we run, and we're the federal partner. And what we do is we assist people to report this and to report the fraud, but also their number, if it's compromised, we could help get them to reissue a Medicare number, a different number. Now, the other thing you could do is you should always review your Medicare statements or your explanation of benefits that come from your plan to make sure that all of the services that are listed are legitimate, that those are the things that you did. You could also call Medicare if you suspect that you've been a victim of a fraud, or just to make sure, at 1-800-MEDICARE to make sure that and you could report it there too. But you know, we have people who are trained, and we're the partners of the federal government to be able to assist with.
Now that the ongoing shutdown is still happening here, is Medicare impacted? Are folks able to reach someone?
They are still able to reach people at 1-800-MEDICARE to be able to report this. And again, they could call us. We're not impacted by that. And people could call us at 1-800-333-4374. And we have people, we have counselors who not only will help you navigate that system, but also we also provide unbiased assistance with healthcare navigation as well. So if you want to check and see if your health coverage will be the same or it's the best one for you for the new year, our staff is able to assist as well. There's something else I wanted to alert people that's for this particular time of the year, is that sometimes you might get people on the other side of the phone trying to pressure you into selecting a plan. So they might say, well, you need to select today because, you know, if not, you're going to lose your coverage, or you're not going to get the same coverage if you don't say today. That is not true. You have until December 7th to make your decision. So anybody who is trying to pressure you to make your decision today, that's another alert that you should be aware of, and you have until December 7th at midnight to make that decision.
What about tips for families or caregivers who want to help protect their loved ones?
Well, again, I always say it's good to not agree to anything on the spot. So if you get information, if people are calling you, it's always good to consult with somebody you trust. So if somebody, you know, a daughter or a son or a neighbor, somebody that you trust, to discuss what all of these options are. And then with some time and distance, then you're able to make a more informed and more calm decision about, you know, because after all, it's about what your health care coverage is for a whole year, for the next year. And again, people can call and get assistance to make these decisions and unbiased decisions, because it's, you know, a lot of times, you know, if you deal with brokers or other plans, they have an interest that you sign up with their particular company. But if you go to an office for the aging, let's say in any county, or you call our helpline, we're not going to sell you anything. We're here to give you all of the information that's pertinent to you, so that you can make the best decision possible.
And before we go, what's the one thing you want folks to take away, the most important message that they should hear about this potential for being scammed?
Well, again, never give out your Medicare number, Social Security number, bank or credit card numbers. And anybody calling you to tell you that you are that they're calling from a Medicare or Social Security office or the IRS, hang up the phone, because they will not call you. And don't let people pressure you into making any decisions. You have until December 7th. You can so that means that you have all of this time to ponder and do research and talk to trusted sources in order to make the right decision for you.
That's Maria Alvarez, Executive Director of the New York Statewide Senior Action Council, or also known as Statewide. If you suspect your Medicare number has been compromised or you've been enrolled in a plan without your permission, contact the New York State Senior Medicare Patrol at 800-333-4374 or visit nyseniors.org. Maria, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, when Brooklyn artist Flaco Jimenez started caring for his grandmother, he uncovered a hidden legacy, one that inspired his latest stage work. It's a new play at NACL this weekend. We'll learn more after this. It's Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. This week, it's an all-American Thanksgiving with the wonderful Padma Lakshmi, just out with a book about the beauty of American food. And Dora Greenspan, baker extraordinaire, who drops by with some fabulous autumn cakes. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11.
on Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Susan Orlean. She is the author of The Library Book and The Orchid Thief, and a longtime writer for The New Yorker. She'll talk with Stephen Wynn about her new collection, Joyride. That's coming up next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. This weekend at NACL Theater, audiences will see a work in progress called Mercedes para las Galeones, created by Brooklyn-based artist Modesto Flaco Jimenez and the Oye Group. The play is inspired by Flaco's grandmother, who raised him in Bushwick after he immigrated from the Dominican Republic. Through letters, receipts, and other personal documents, Flaco discovered her quiet but powerful role in helping Latino families survive and thrive. The play, performed primarily in Spanish with English supertitles, explores memory, matriarchy, identity, and cultural inheritance. Joining us today are Flaco Jimenez and Zulema Guevara, who brings the lead role of Mercedes to life on stage. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Flaco, this show's inspired by your grandmother. Tell us a little bit about her and what inspired you to bring her story to the stage.
Yeah, the Mercedes Vinales, the matriarch, the one that opened her doors for many generations to like ground themselves in America, in North America, in New York City. America is what I've learned developing this play is like the things that we embed in our minds, that is, we forget South America, Central America, mm-hmm. but knowing the reality that is New York City, where she like gave a lot of us a moment of breather and a moment to like really find ourselves in that apartment, in that third floor mansion, what she called it, to be able to like build a whole new world for ourselves before we open that door to like be able to see what New York City life can provide.
You cared for her as she battled dementia. She had letters and personal documents and even receipts that you discovered. Tell us a little bit about the process of discovering these things and then how that inspired you to create this work.
Yeah. While she had dementia, I kept going into drawers and going into different boxes and realizing that she never threw anything out. Like a true beautiful hoarder. And in all of that, I ended up finding a lot of the letters of like people from the Dominican Republic asking for things and how she took care of them, and just realizing like, oh, this woman didn't just take care of me and my uncle and my father. She actually took care of multiple generations, even back in the motherland. And that just like showed me like, wait, I have to celebrate her.
Is it through that discovery of what started out as like maybe pieces of ephemera or just, you know, a beautiful hoarder's items, and then you discover these relationships through them? Is that what inspired you to then take this action to create the work?
In the process of uncovering all those stuff, I really realized that, oh, this story, this might not just be me. I have to tell this story because there's something here about like secrecy that shouldn't be a secret, because you did a lot. And I've heard little remnants of this from other people when I have conversations about, yeah, your mother did a lot, and not Mercedes herself, but other Latinos, and secrecy is a big thing.
Yeah.
Feeling like they don't have to share that, like they already done enough because they are in New York City and they should be blessed that they are in New York City. But then that forgetfulness of like the true migrational lift and the true migrational trauma that could cause. I felt that it was time for like lifting that veil and like sharing some of those pains, but sharing all the beautiful tools that she actually built by giving me a lock in that bathroom and making sure that I could have a bathroom to like study my lines and be a performer and be a writer. And like, wait, people should know that these are tools you were creating. Mm. And people should know that there's like more to just like migrating to New York City, and like those simple little tools that she left behind were able to give me a space of breather and to be more than just not saying that there's anything wrong with being a cab driver, but Like, you could be more than just like what your uncle and your father were. You could be more than whatever you just see down the street, and share those tools, because those tools will like facilitate other people.
Yeah, you're exploring the cultural identity of growing up in Bushwick, and her experience and your experience, memory, identity, all of those things come together in this work. And Salima, you play Mercedes.
Yes.
What drew you to this role?
Flaco. Yeah. I met him years ago, and he told me I reminded him of his grandmother. And it started, he was just in the developmental stage of writing the piece back then. But once he approached me a couple of years ago and sent me the script, it reminded me a lot of my own mother. You know, we emigrate here. We work our butts off. You know, immigrants work their asses off, for lack of a better phrase. And, you know, my parents raised us in kind of the same vein. You know, they were working, but they were always sending back, you know, money, resources to Venezuela to help people there, and that continued until the day my mother passed. She was still doing the same thing, and there is that element of secrecy, the element of like, you don't want to be thanked for, you don't want to elevate yourself in a certain way. My mother never wanted to put herself out as any kind of savior. You know, she felt like that's what you do, you just help. But she didn't realize how rare that was, and so Flaco's story mirrored mine in a lot of ways. We've both dealt with losing a parent, you know, a caregiver to Alzheimer's. And so it feels very, very much like my own story. And getting to know Mercedes through her writing and through her, you know, the stories about her life has made me fall in love with her.
You know? What are some of those discoveries that you found that made you fall in love with her, and then, you know, help shape your role, your performance?
Well, the idea that, I mean, she came and she had, what was it, like 10 different jobs?
Yeah.
You know, she
yeah.
worked.
Like, she sold Avon products, Stanley products, back when Popular Club Plan was a thing, mm-hmm. like making sure that family members had their cakes and their birthday ornaments, and like she made them herself by hand. So there was just like a really true business-oriented person, mm-hmm, to make mm-hmm. sure that there was always some type of capital coming into the household,
right.
And never bragging about it. Just like, hey, I'm a cook. Go take this food over to the mechanics. Mm-hmm. They're going to give you money.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do this. Go take it over here. They're going to give you money. And yeah. always the hustle without bragging about, I'm right. doing everything for a bunch of people.
She's just and doing it.
Hey, grandma, I need this amount of money for this uniform, for this. And you being like, wait, but she never says no. There's always capital that she pulls out of the mattress, or out of this weird drawer, or out of this like jacket, or somewhere, somehow, there's always some money being, which then I ended up finding through these moments of opening boxes, being like, oh, look at this envelope full of money.
Yeah.
That she was still,
yeah.
she
yeah.
still has stashes
yeah.
for
when,
for a moment of like, oh, I got the letter from the Dominican Republic saying they need a bunch of things, some medicine for someone yeah. that's sick. Go into that jacket. Then in forgetfulness and in that Alzheimer's, I ended up then uncovering a lot of those things. Where like the one of the beautiful papers that I remember is like seeing the receipt of how much she paid for me, for my father, myself, and my uncle to bring us to America, down to how much she paid for the passport pictures. Mm-hmm. And like that moment was like, wow, she did all this math and everything has an envelope that she stashed it in, not just for-
And she could barely read, right?
Yeah.
And she could barely read. This woman was so resourceful,
mm-hmm.
and she didn't have the luxury of an education, you know, but she figured it out. She figured it out and she figured it out through love. You know,
so let me, you're talking about your connection to this type, this character type. How do you approach a role like this when the character is so personal to the author, the person who mm-hmm. wrote the play?
Well, getting to know Flaco, you know, like asking about, like, I've met some of Flaco's family members, so I, you know, a few of them came up to me when we did it at Cage in Brooklyn, and they were like, oh my God, you remind me so much. There's something about me clearly that that has the essence of Mercedes. So whenever someone said that, I was like, okay, what is it? You know, like, what was it? My smile? Is it the tone of my voice or my energy? So that was the in for me, asking those kinds of questions. Like, what is it about Mercedes that I'm embodying without knowing?
It's been a couple of years of us developing the piece. In 2023, we put up a version that I love living in energy. And it was this moment that I felt in 2023 that when I was attempting to put up the first full draft of this, I felt like my grandmother was telling me, no, first I have to carry this play by myself. And Suleyma did a beautiful, amazing job putting up like an hour of the version of the play where she spoke to everyone. But the bodies or the spirits of the sons and the family members had no lines. So it was just Suleyma carrying the full production.
This Saturday night at NACL, this is another version. This is still a work in progress. Mm-hmm. It's presented in Spanish with English supertitles. Talk about how that was an important choice, too. Is that your grandmother also speaking to you through this, that it needs to be performed this way?
It's a beautiful moment that we're also using that in the production of, like, why are you telling our story? So these layers of also learning the tongue. And like when she landed, none of us knew English. So the production should respect that moment of it. And I felt like she has been pushing those moments through the writing, which is like, no, tell it how it was. And then those English moments that you need to adapt, make sure that they actually are respecting a moment of us getting tools together. Making sure that you're sharing these tools for everyone to know. It's like, yes, you could have the super titles, but there are going to be moments that you're speaking full in English to make sure that we all get that we're tool sharing right now. We don't want you to do that much lift, but we want you to like understand there are tools for you to take home here. This is not about trauma sharing. This is a beautiful moment about to know that we take care of ours. So you should be taking care of yours, because my grandmother is not the only person with Alzheimer's, just like Suleyma said, right? Some of the actors that are helping me develop this piece are also sharing their own personal moments about, oh yeah, my family, I dealt with a case like this. And it's those are the moments of unlifting the veil, of really speaking to each other and really listening to each other, like, oh, even in the development process of it, we are lifting this veil and healing with each other to make sure that we know it's not just the actors, it's gonna bless the audience.
Yeah.
The production has had a documentary developed where we brought in a bunch of doctors to speak about it. And like, how do we share all these tools? How do we go to senior centers to speak to seniors about this is happening? How do we go and like create a VR version that can help other actors like get glimpses of this? So we have been developing other mediums of like, how do we communicate that caring for yours after they did for you? Is a beautiful, beautiful moment that is actually a celebration of forgetfulness, but also time travel with your person in dementia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been having a lot of fun and a lot of healing of like documenting her life.
Is that what you've been getting through these various versions of the work in progress? More healing, each phase of it is a different phase of healing?
Yeah, it's been realizing that the director always brings this up, Brisa Arelis Muñoz, who's directing the piece. She's always bringing up to me, like, you remember when you said this, that you were doing all this work for the people, but then you'll, like, slip in a line where it's just like, oh, man, I'm also healing. You're waking up to the reality that those tools you're creating are actually tools you're creating for yourself. But because you are like your grandmother and selfless and wanting to just give, you don't want to accept. So you also got to remind yourself and lift that veil on yourself to like, you are creating these worlds of tools and healing and sharing because you also want to heal and you don't want to just trauma share. You want to make sure that it's a beautiful collaboration of tool sharing to more clarity and celebration of the people that did for us.
Well, and is that what you hope the audience gets from this? Because as we're speaking about this, I'm reflecting back on just my grandparents who had a different experience, but just in the general sense of immigrants, there is this secrecy. There's this just do for the family without talking about it through a lot of the immigrant experience, no matter what heritage. And so do you feel that the audience can take some of that healing or that celebration away through this work?
That's what I got from putting up the documentary that we created for this piece, like the documenting of everything that is, of me taking care of her, of me trying to figure out the writing, of me trying to figure out how do I get this in a VR. We've been documenting it all, and we put up the documentary at BAM in December 2024. And what I saw there was all the different faces and colors and like nations and crying. And it wasn't the Dominican that was, the Dominican was also crying, but mm-hmm. it was also like the Asian families were crying. Like the people that don't even speak Spanish were crying. And that gave me that moment of like, oh, we all have this migrational quietness of not, and secrecy that I'm sharing in this documentary that is like, oh, you know what this is. Mm-hmm. Here's some tools so you can also let it out. Here's some crayons. Here's some coloring books. Here's a notebook for you to write it out. And people are coming up to me being like, yeah, my mother. Yeah, my uncle. Yeah, my father had this. And man, it's, thank you for sharing it, because now I could go back and like I could talk to my sister more. Or I could talk to my cousin more about like how we can help each other to make sure that we can get to the next stage. And not by the end of her passing, it's not us forgetting, mm-hmm. but it's actually us celebrating them in this moment of that people feel it should be so hard, but it's actually a beautiful celebration now because they did. Now it's time for you to do.
What's next after this staged reading? Do you continue to shape it, and do you have a time in mind where you think it might be finished, or does it keep going?
The show opens at the Bushwick Star in 2027 in Brooklyn, in Bushwick, in the neighborhood that she raised us all in.
Oh, wow, amazing.
So we already found this beautiful theater that's going to host us to make sure that we present it. And we're really now working towards that goal. And while we're doing those goals of like getting the stage play up, which is to me is like, after doing 5 years of going to senior centers and working with elders, going to Princeton, going to Cali to make sure that we can share all these tools that we built with elders, that has nothing to do with the theater piece, right? It's just this moment of me like sharing the tools that helped me celebrate her while she was going through all of this. Mm-hmm. Okay, now we can focus on the stage play more. But through that, let's continue to work with City Meals on Wheels and going into homes. And going into the projects and going into all these centers in New York City and in the five boroughs. And shout out to City Meals on Wheels for partnering up with us and being able to like serenade people at home where they can't go to the senior center anymore, and dropping off a meal and letting us drop off a care package with a bunch of tools that support the caregiver, but also the person going through it, to have a moment of breather and like joy with each other so like they can dance. Mm-hmm.
That's Flaco Jimenez on his new play, Mercedes para los Caleones, and Zulema Guevara, who plays Mercedes. It's a love letter to Flaco's grandmother and the generations of Latino families she helped along the way. The work in progress will be presented this Saturday night at NACL Theater with English supertitles and a warm bowl of soup awaiting you afterwards, which I think that Mercedes would have liked and appreciated.
She loved me making her sancocho.
You can find more information at nacl.org. Thank you both. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, you can find this show and all of our local programming at our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA. We meet a family that was recently deported to Honduras, despite having legal protections to remain in the U.S. We learn how their story is now part of a broader legal effort to return families like theirs, who should be protected under a legal settlement with the U.S. government. That's this week on Latino USA. Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill, keeping you connected with the local edition. Weeknights at 6, right after All Things Considered. The local edition, only on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Occasional snow showers mixing with rain continuing this afternoon, a high of 38. Showers early tonight, then cloudy overnight with a low of 34. Tomorrow, mainly cloudy. We'll see a mixture of rain and snow showers developing in the afternoon, a high 41.